is Friday, February 19th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. We speak to the UN Special Rapporteur for Myanmar.
Those protesters who were so courageously on the ground and standing up for their rights, and who really need to know that they're not alone.
Plus, dispelling myths about COVID-19 vaccines.
So it's not like we just found this technology within the past year for COVID.
And the planet Mars has a new resident. We'll have these stories and more next. Protesters were out again across Myanmar on Thursday, and Reuters' Libby Hogan is up first.
The Myanmar military issued arrest warrants for six celebrities who were accused of encouraging civil servants to strike and join the protest against this month's coup. The strikes have paralyzed many government offices and businesses, but one name on the warrant list, actor Lu Min, posted defiantly on his Facebook page that, quote, "It's amazing to see the unity of our people. People's power must return to the people." Despite junta appeals for civil servants to return to work and threats if they do not, there has been no sign of the strikes easing. Motorists in Yangon also continued with a campaign to show their opposition to the coup by driving at a snail pace throughout downtown traffic on Thursday. Last night, in the country's second largest city, Mandalay, security forces opened fire with rubber bullets on railway workers who had gone on strike earlier in the week. That's according to local residents. And one charity worker was wounded in the leg. Neither the army nor the police made any immediate comment on the incident, but the army's Facebook page said forces were providing security and, quote, "to make sure people have tranquility and sound sleep." Nearly 500 people have been arrested for taking part in the protests.
Libby Hogan reports for Reuters News. VOA's UN correspondent Margaret Rashier earlier spoke with UN Myanmar Special Rapporteur Tom Andrews. Mr. Andrews discussed the lengths to which people from inside the country are sharing information as to what's going on.
People are opposing this coup at great risk to themselves. And, of course, we rely upon people who are willing to obviously take very courageous actions publicly, but also provide us with vitally important information behind the scenes. So we've had fits and starts with communications capacity. The internet keeps going down, as we know, by design by the Tamada. What is remarkable is not only the courage of people coming forward with information, but also their ingenuity in being able to get information to us, analysis to us, videos, photographs, the kind of information that we need in order to provide those who are advising with as accurate a picture of what's going on as humanly possible. So as the special rapporteur on the situation of human rights in Myanmar, it's critical that I have access to that information, and it's critical that I can provide that to the United Nations and the broader international community. And while it may be challenging from time to time to do that, while I'm not on the ground there, obviously, at this moment, the technology that's available and the savviness of people on the ground to use that technology have been working out quite well.
So, Special Rapporteur, tell us how else the international community can support the people in Myanmar right now.
Well, first of all, voices. It really, really makes a difference when people speak out against what has gone on. And we need to have a chorus of voices from all sectors, all over the world, speaking up. We also need, as I was mentioning, the initiation of bilateral sanctions, if you will, economic sanctions. I think that there's a very important role to play for arms being embargoed, an arms embargo, a coordinator around the world. I think it's important that diplomatic options are examined, that in which the diplomatic community can be communicating in very uncertain terms, that this is unacceptable to the community of nations and will not be accepted. So there's a variety of ways that people can support those protesters who were so courageously on the ground and standing up for their rights, and who really need to know that they're not alone.
Tom Andrews is the United Nations Special Rapporteur on the situation of human rights in Myanmar. He was speaking to VOA UN correspondent Margaret Bashir. Britain is placing sanctions on three of Myanmar's military leaders over the February 1st coup that ousted the country's elected government. It's a move that's being echoed by Canada as well. The British government says that it's also ending aid programs that send money to the Myanmar government, though it says aid would still reach the poorest and most vulnerable in the country. Reports have emerged of a massacre in Ethiopia's holiest city as the region slowly resumes telephone service after 3 months of conflict. The AP's Karen Chamas is up next.
A local deacon has told the Associated Press that he believes over 800 people were killed on a weekend in November at the Ethiopian Orthodox Church in Aksum and around the city. Bodies with gunshot wounds lay in the streets for days. At night, residents listened in horror as hyenas fed on the corpses of people they knew. But they were forbidden from burying their dead by the invading Eritrean soldiers. Ethiopian Prime Minister and Nobel Prize winner Abiy Ahmed announced the fighting as the world focused on the US election. He accused Tigray's regional forces of attacking the Ethiopian military. I'm Karen Chamas.
On Thursday, NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg said defense ministers had made no final decision on its military presence in Afghanistan.
The peace process is the best chance to end years of suffering and violence and bring lasting peace. It is important for the Afghan people, for the security of the region, and for our own security. But the talks are fragile and progress is slow. So it is now imperative to re-energize the peace process. All sides must seize this historic opportunity for a peaceful settlement without further delay.
NATO has just under 10,000 troops in the war-ravaged country, helping to train and advise Afghan security forces. Decisions have also been made, however, to increase training for Iraqi security forces from 500 personnel to around 4,000. And training activities will now include more Iraqi security institutions and areas beyond Baghdad. U.S. Senator Ted Cruz flew into a storm of criticism on Thursday over a holiday jaunt that he took to the Mexican resort city of Cancun, while his home state of Texas continued grappling with a deadly deep freeze. This report is produced by Yahaira Yaquez from Reuters News.
As millions of Texans struggled through a deadly deep freeze, U.S. Senator Ted Cruz flew to the Mexican resort city of Cancun with his family. The 50-year-old Republican lawmaker confirmed the trip on Thursday, but cut it short after his travels were reported. Reuters snapped this picture of Cruz leaving Mexico. In a statement, Cruz said, quote, "With school canceled for the week, our girls asked to take a trip with friends. Wanting to be a good dad, I flew down with them last night, and I'm flying back this afternoon. My staff and I are in constant communication with state and local leaders to get to the bottom of what happened in Texas." Cruz, viewed as a potential presidential candidate in 2024, faced calls to resign after photos on social media emerged showing him in an airport line, in a passenger lounge, aboard an airliner, and departing an airport in Mexico. The scandal came as millions of Texans remained paralyzed by power and water outages after a winter storm and freezing temperatures hampered efforts to restore full power. So far, nearly two dozen deaths have been attributed to the cold snap. Some in Houston found shelter at the Gallery Furniture Store, which had opened its doors as a warming center. Meanwhile, in Austin, a Target saw empty shelves and long lines as shoppers stocked up on food. With 2.7 million Texas households on Thursday still without heat, leaders warned of a domino effect on infrastructure as the lack of power cut off water supplies, strained the ability of hospitals to treat COVID-19 patients, and isolated vulnerable communities with frozen roads still impassable.
Reuters reporter Yahaira Yaquez. People the world over have questions about the COVID-19 vaccines. Most have heard rumors about their safety, and even some healthcare workers and members of the U.S. military have opted out of getting immunized. VOA's Carol Pearson helps debunk some common myths about the COVID-19 vaccines.
Scientists around the world have rushed to find a vaccine to protect against the virus that's caused the COVID-19 pandemic. The virus has claimed more than 2 million lives and infected more than 100 million people. Yet despite the proven protection that COVID vaccines offer, people still have doubts about getting one.
I don't know what to believe, so either believe the news, believe social media, believe whatever is out there, you know?
I'm a little bit skeptical because I want to know, how is it going to affect my immune system?
I don't see why I would take a vaccine for something that I may not ever get.
The skepticism is just as real in sprawling cities like Los Angeles and in the small towns of West Virginia.
The bad part about it is if it goes wrong and you do get a virus from it, then what?
Some vaccines are made from weakened or dead viruses, but experts say there's no need to worry. Dr. Tosin Goji of the Cleveland Clinic was trained in infectious diseases.
No, it's not going to give you COVID. It's not a live vaccine. You're not going to get a COVID infection.
Although the vaccines are new, Dr. Goji says the technology used to make them is not.
It was initially put together for cancer patients. So it's not like we just found this technology within the past year for COVID. It's something that has been in place. And when the opportunity came, it was like an aha moment, like we can use this technology for this.
The World Health Organization has a web page that addresses the myths and concerns about the vaccines and the virus itself, including who can get COVID-19. The answer, everyone. Can certain foods like garlic protect against COVID? What about dietary supplements or vitamins? The World Health Organization says there's no evidence they can. And then there's a belief that these vaccines can change your genetic code.
It will destroy your DNA and you'll become part of like a transhuman because they're putting nanoparticles into it.
The Pfizer, Moderna, and Sputnik vaccines are mRNA vaccines or messenger RNA vaccines. Remember the spike protein on the COVID virus? These vaccines teach our cells how to make a protein or even a piece of a protein that triggers an immune response inside our bodies. Dr. Tosin Goji says these fears are not warranted.
It's not changing your DNA. People think, oh, it's going to change me. And that's why I take the pictures. It's not integrating itself into your DNA. No, it's not changing who you are.
The World Health Organization is calling for massive public education campaigns to address people's concerns and their fears. Experts say vaccines, along with prevention efforts, keeping hands clean, wearing masks, and social distancing, will put an end to the pandemic, but only if people follow these practices. Carol Pearson.
And coming up later.
Africa, especially the savanna regions of Africa, are quite unique in the world in that these vegetation fires are a very normal part of these ecosystems.
This is VOA News.
This is Science in a Minute.
A trio of astronomers confirmed their 2018 discovery of the most distant planetoid in the solar system. Scott Shepard, Chad Trujillo, and David Tholen were observing the night sky with the Subaru 8-meter telescope atop Hawaii's Mauna Kea, hoping to spot the theoretical planet 9 when they found a minor planet they nicknamed Far, Far Out. The trio has since conducted further observations to confirm their discovery and determine the object's orbit. They say that Far, Far Out, now officially known as 2018 AG 37, is now about 132 astronomical units or AUs away from the sun. An astronomical unit is 150 million kilometers. The astronomers determined that 2018 AG 37 has an elongated orbit that takes it as far out from the sun as 175 AUs and gets to within Neptune's orbit at 27 AUs. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. UNICEF, the United Nations International Children's Emergency Fund, has released a new report stating that the lives and futures of more than 3 million displaced children are at risk in the Democratic Republic of the Congo. Earlier, I spoke with Edouard Begbude, UNICEF's representative in the DRC. Begbude began our conversation by describing how things got to where they are.
I think that the best I could say is to underline what the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, Marta Hurtado, describes. I mean, she said that the violence and abuse against the civilian population in the east of DRC as possibly amounting to crimes against humanity. There is many different area of conflict in the eastern DRC. And speaking about only the ADF, there is many Mai-Mai groups, there is different armed groups in that part of the country. And because of their activities, we have now still having over 3 million displaced children which are at risk in that location. There is two issues which I would like to really to underline. First is that it's years and years that we have displaced people and displaced children in DRC. So it's not something new, but little by little it's forgotten. The second issue is that when you go to one of the camps, you are meeting 90p children, and then you meet a mother who used to be as well an IDP children at a time. And sometimes you meet as well the grandmother, and the grandmother was also an IDP children in the 90s. So there is a kind of perpetuation of generation after generation being displaced in that part of the country.
You know, you're facing the situation, as you said, you know, decades going back to the 1990s. And in the report, UNICEF is calling for an end to the conflict, to put an end to the humanitarian disaster that has developed in the DRC, leading to these 3 million children being internally displaced. But from your point of view, from UNICEF's point of view, what is really needed to make that happen? Because simply calling for it doesn't make it so.
Well, you need naturally peace, and you need to have the right settlement of these people, ever in the area of origin, ever in new area of settlement. And I think that what they really need when they settle again is naturally to have a minimum of service on health and nutrition and receiving proper food and shelter and water. But then is to build the future, is to being able to bring education to them. Is as well to have peace education program, so that then you try to cut the same situation happen after a few months or few years. You need to give an idea of the future for these children, so that when they become adolescents, they have a different alternative than to again being part of a new conflict and being enrolled by one of the militia or others.
Who do you see as playing the leading roles in making that change?
Well, I believe definitely the transition. You know, MONUSCO is there, and as little by little, there is some armed groups who are ready now to give up their action. There is some opportunities in some areas, and we need, as we are doing, responding to an emergency, thinking at the transition and the development at the same time.
Edouard Begbude is the DRC representative for UNICEF, and he was speaking to me from Kinshasa. NASA and the United States have successfully landed the Perseverance on Mars, while spacecraft from the UAE and China remain in orbit. VOA's Arash Arabasadi reports on the challenges that await the rover, as well as a potential treasure trove of discoveries.
7 months after launching from Florida's Cape Canaveral, NASA's Perseverance rover completed a space journey of nearly 500 million kilometers to the surface of Mars. The mission ahead? To search the red planet for signs of ancient life. For now, NASA scientists like Lori Glaze are breathing a sigh of relief after the perilous landing.
It is definitely the most dangerous thing we have to do, and the most challenging thing is entering the Mars atmosphere. Mars atmosphere is very thin. It's about 1% of Earth's atmosphere, so it's just enough atmosphere that we get really hot coming in, but not enough atmosphere to slow us down, so very challenging.
NASA aimed to park its rover at the Jezero crater that scientists believe was once filled with water, an essential prerequisite for life as we know it. Perseverance is the biggest vehicle NASA has to rove on Mars. On board is the helicopter Ingenuity. Together, they will survey the Martian surface and collect samples that could answer an age-old question: did life ever exist beyond Earth? But that's not all, according to NASA's Thomas Serbuggen.
What's so exciting about this, it's not only the landing and the investigations, which is the search for extinct ancient life from a time where life arose on Earth. If everything goes exactly like we hope, late in the 20s, we're going to go pick up the samples this vehicle is collecting and bringing it back to Earth for the first round trip to the planet Mars.
Perseverance is scheduled to spend at least one Martian year or two Earth years exploring the landing site region of the ancient river delta in a lake that once filled the Jezero crater. Arash Arabasadi, VOA News.
And finally, it's often fairly simple to see a connection between industrializing societies and air pollution. But a recent study using satellite data indicates that some rapidly developing portions of the savanna lands of eastern and southern Africa, pollution has actually decreased during the dry season. It's a time when wildfires set by people usually fill the air with dangerous amounts of nitrogen dioxide, ozone, and other pollutants. Now, to find out more about the seemingly topsy-turvy result, where a growing population is accompanied by cleaner air, VOA's Adam Phillips spoke with Earth scientist Jonathan Hickman. Mr. Hickman is a senior fellow in the NASA postdoctoral program at the Goddard Institute for Space Studies and the lead author of the report.
Africa, especially the savanna regions of Africa, are quite unique in the world in that these vegetation fires are a very normal part of these ecosystems, but they also emit a lot of pollutants. And one of those pollutants is nitrogen dioxide, which in the atmosphere, in the lower atmosphere, it's involved in a number of respiratory diseases. And it also causes the formation of other gases like ozone, which if you think about smog, a lot of what's in smog is ozone. And though that's great in the upper atmosphere where it protects us from solar radiation, in the lower atmosphere, it's another air pollutant. And it actually causes between 10 and 20,000 premature deaths in Africa every year.
So tell us in a nutshell what your study discovered.
Usually what we see is as countries grow economically, they emit more air pollutants, a lot of it from driving your cars or increasing electricity production, things like that. But we find that during the dry part of the year, when these vegetation fires are happening, we're seeing a decrease.
I know that some fires are a natural feature of savanna ecology, but most fires are human-caused, right, by nomads. Why do they set these fires?
The reasons why people do that is sometimes set small fires to prevent large ones from happening. In other cases, these grasslands are used for livestock, so burning these fires can be helpful to improving the nutrient cycling in these systems and helping produce more forage for those livestock.
Oh, you think that unburned grass would be more appetizing as forage?
You would think, but after burns, the fire does a nice job of remineralizing a lot of nutrients. And so the grasses that grow the next year are just going to be that much tastier.
So again, what are the main reasons why there are fewer fires in these savanna areas now?
One is that every year you're going to get a different amount of rainfall. And if that dry season is shorter, you're just not going to have as much fire. But probably more important factor is human activity. Humans have changed the way that they interact with this savanna landscape. So in the past, people will be setting fires to manage the landscape and to make it more productive. But now there's more and more cropped agriculture. So people are planting crops like maize. And in those cases, they aren't setting fires to the same degree degree. And as villages grow and population density increases and there are more roads, there's more infrastructure that people want to protect from fires. So as a consequence, we're seeing this kind of socioeconomic change and a reduction in the amount of fires that are occurring. But the one thing to note is that this is really a phenomenon that's happening only during the dry season. These are the most polluted months of the year in these regions. But if we look at the rainy season, when there aren't fires occurring, there is still an increase in NO2 and air pollution generally as more fossil fuel is being burned. So there's a good news story for part of the year, and it is the part of the year where air pollution is most dangerous, but it's a little bit more nuanced.
And you expect this trend to continue?
There may be a point, and we expect there'll be a point where the anthropogenic emissions start to outweigh the reductions that we're seeing in fire. But what we're seeing now is this sort of opportunity. So we have a little bit more time to try to implement the kind of policies that could prevent worse air pollution from occurring. And hopefully some of these greener energy technologies can be implemented and will leapfrog over some of the dirtier, older technologies and avoid some of the air pollution events that occurred in other countries when they grew economically.
You sound hopeful.
I am. The history is one which might lead you to be a little bit less hopeful. If you look at the instances in China or India, it was only when air quality got to be extremely bad that policies started to be implemented to avoid those air pollution events. But I think we've seen a lot of opportunities for innovation in Africa, and a lot of them have been taken up, leading to better outcomes in the future. And hopefully this can be another one of them.
That was NASA postdoctoral senior fellow Jonathan Hickman, and he was speaking to VOA's Adam Phillips. And you've been listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of our entire production team, thank you very much for listening. Be sure to stay up to date with world news and events 24 hours a day. You can do so by pointing your web browser on your phone, your tablet, your desktop computer, or any other electronic device to voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Be well and be safe.
Editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
President Joe Biden outlined his main foreign policy goals for the near future. Chief among them is to end the war in Yemen. Yemen is the poorest of all Arab countries. The country has long suffered with endemic poverty, much of it the result of lack of water and other resources, high population growth, periodic local conflicts, and chronic food insecurity. On top of that, a civil war that began in 2014 soon turned into an indirect conflict between Iran and a coalition of Arab countries, headed by Saudi Arabia. And as is usual in armed conflict, it is the civilian population that suffers the most. Today, over 24.3 million people in Yemen qualify for some sort of humanitarian aid and protection. Since 2015, tens of thousands of civilians have been killed and some 3.6 million have been displaced from their homes. We're stepping up our diplomacy to end the war in Yemen, a war which has created a humanitarian and strategic catastrophe, said President Biden.
I've asked my Middle East team to ensure our support for the United Nations-led initiative to impose a ceasefire, open humanitarian challenge, and restore long dormant peace talks.
At the same time, President Biden announced the appointment of longtime diplomat and Gulf expert Timothy Lenderking as the U.S. Special Envoy to Yemen. He will oversee U.S. diplomatic efforts to end the war.
Tim has lifelong experience in the region, and he'll work with the U.N. Envoy and all parties of the conflict to push for a diplomatic resolution. And Tim's diplomacy will be bolstered by USAID working to ensure that humanitarian aid is reaching the Yemeni people who are suffering unendurable devastation.
Finally, President Biden said the United States is ending all American support for offensive operations in the war in Yemen, including relevant arms sales. However, the United States will not abandon its campaign against al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, much of which takes place in Yemen, nor will it cease its support of Saudi Arabia's defensive capabilities.
Saudi Arabia faces missile attacks UAV strikes, and other threats from Iranian-supplied forces in multiple countries. We're going to continue to support and help Saudi Arabia defend its sovereignty and its territorial integrity and its people.
This war, said President Biden, has to end.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States.